Many students look forward to building a life and becoming independent. But for millions of young adults, that opportunity seems far away.
Geography plays an enormous role in the kinds of opportunities available to young adults.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about these young people who are disconnected from success. We'll also spend an academic minute with successful students who feel like imposters. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. For many young adults today, the transition to independence is a time of excitement and possibility. But nearly 5 million young people, more than 10% of youth aged 16 to 24, experience entry into adulthood as abrupt abandonment, a time of disconnection from school, work, and family. For this growing population of Americans, which includes kids aging out of foster care and those entangled with the justice system, life screeches to a halt when adulthood arrives. Journalist Ann Kim talks about this generation of young people in her new book called Abandoned: America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Ann Kim is a senior writer and contributing editor at The Washington Monthly. I asked her why she took on this story.
Well, you know, I have been writing about poverty and social policy and economic opportunity for a long time, and I cannot pretend that I discovered this issue. It's been there in plain sight for at least the past 20 years, and there have been any number of nonprofit organizations that have been kind of toiling in the trenches for decades now to help young people. It's actually shocking to me that this problem of the 4.5 million young people ages 16 to 24 who are both out of school and out of work haven't gotten the attention they need. My book should actually be the 10th book about this topic, not among the first to bring this to popular attention.
Well, let's just get an idea of what we're talking about. What's your definition of disconnection?
Sure. You know, one of the things that needs to happen is a common definition of what we mean by disconnection, because there are researchers who defined this group of young people who are out of school and out of work as 16 to 24 or 18 to 24 in the United Kingdom and other parts of the world where there's a little bit more practice monitoring this population. It is 16 to 24-year-olds who are out of work and out of school.
And this is not a book where it's, these kids today.
No, definitely not. There are many stereotypes, I think, about who disconnected young people are. You know, you may think that it's a 20-year-old who's in his parents' basement playing video games all day, or it's a question of, you know, poor life choices or personal responsibility. That's not what this book is about. This book is about the real structural barriers that are standing in the way of so many young people getting ahead in life. You know, they may not be living in neighborhoods where there are jobs available to them or educational opportunities. There are 41 million Americans, according to the Urban Institute, who live in what are called rural higher education deserts. They are more than half an hour away from the nearest college or community college. And you know, in today's economy, you really need to have some sort of post-secondary education credential to get any sort of living wage job. It's not about desire or choices. It's really about structure. And that's what this book tries to uncover. It's like these hidden structural barriers to what is preventing so many young people from reaching the aspirations that they have.
You do point out in the book the difference between these young people's circumstances versus their choices. And it's really the circumstances that you're talking about, too. You also talk that you do not like the word idle when describing them. Why is that?
They're not. They're hustling like crazy. They're working like crazy to try to get ahead. Idle is a really unfortunate word that was used maybe 20, 25 years ago when this problem of youth unemployment was beginning to get the attention of policymakers a few decades back. And, you know, youth unemployment actually is a global problem. You may remember a few decades back there were some summer jobs programs and lots of attention for a little while placed on quote-unquote urban youth. It, I think, created some negative stereotypes about whom we're talking about. What I'd really try to uncover here is that geography plays an enormous role in the kinds of opportunities available to young adults. The kinds of connections and family support and community support and networks that young people have access to, which have become so much more important now, especially as the runway into adult independence has gotten much longer over the last 20, 30 years than in years past. There are many more things that make it a lot harder to be a successful young adult today. And that's part of also what this book tries to cover, like how this road to adulthood has really changed and the divergence in experiences that young adults are seeing based upon the means that are available to them and based upon family and zip code and other circumstances that they may or may not be blessed to have.
You talked about geography a lot, and you just did there. Is this nationwide? Is it regional? Where is this? Is this a clustered problem? Where can we find this?
I think what's happening with young people is a indication of some broader trends around huge regional inequality that we've been seeing really accelerate over the last decade or so. You can look at our politics to see how polarized we have become. It's not just political, it's economic and it's social. The coasts are becoming wealthier and more educated. The places in between, not so much. That being said, there are pockets of disconnection all over the country, depending upon your access to education, to infrastructure, transportation. If you don't have the means to get to a job, then you're going to remain disconnected. It's certainly the case. One of the surprises, I think, for a lot of people I've spoken with recently is that disconnection is a much bigger problem in rural America than it is in urban centers, because of this geographic distance from school and from jobs. If you look at a map of disconnection, there's a fantastic nonprofit called the Measure of America Project at the Social Science Research Council that is one of the organizations that has mapped the problem of youth disconnection. And you'll see that the South has more problem with young people being connected to school and to work than other parts of the country. And you will see that there's definitely more disconnection in the rural areas of the country, for sure, north and south. But it is a pervasive problem nationally.
And earlier you spoke about educational deserts. In the book, you talk about opportunity deserts, and it's not just rural. You say there are both urban and rural opportunity deserts, right?
Yes. An example of an urban opportunity desert I talk about in the book is a neighborhood in Baltimore called Sandtown. And there's a lot that's going right in Baltimore. You know, there's an Amazon facility that's there now. There's Under Armour. There's quite a bit of activity around the Inner Harbor. But if you go to Sandtown, which is in the heart of Baltimore, you really will see block upon block of boarded up homes. And this was a thriving neighborhood. In the 30s, 40s, they had jazz greats who grew up there. Thurgood Marshall came from this neighborhood. Things fell apart, and there's no question that there were policies that contributed to the decline of this neighborhood. Redlining, segregation, intentional policies that were intended to, you know, really oppress the population in Baltimore, and it's had its impact. If you're growing up there, you really have no access to jobs. You have very little access to decent schooling. You know, we've made great progress on the nation's dropout rate, but some of the nation's worst so-called dropout factories are right there in this neighborhood. And that's an example of one of these urban opportunity deserts that I talk about. And unfortunately, there's quite a few of them. There's, you know, several dozen of them sprinkled across the country.
However, you do also talk about superstar cities. Now, what do you call a superstar city, and are they a solution or are they part of the problem?
They're both. It's an interesting question because on the one hand, superstar cities are fantastic places to be if you're a young person who has a college education, who has parents who can hook you up with that great first internship and that great first job. You know, the world is your oyster at that point. This is the place where all these, you know, so-called skills gaps are happening, where, you know, employers are begging for young workers to come. And there's certainly a lot of young people who are thriving. But you have to be in the right place at the right time with the right connections, the right education, and all of that. If you don't have access to those things, the superstar city is nothing but an empty aspiration for you. And it's that divergence in the ability to succeed, to even dream about getting to a superstar city, let alone finding a job there, that I think is an underappreciated driver of inequality, regional discontent, and some of the political problems that our nation has been wrestling with. We have a generation of young people who are growing up potentially under potential, discontent, and being deprived of the opportunities that they need to succeed. So we're going to pay the price for that 10 years down the road, for sure.
How much of this is a hangover from the Great Recession?
You know, things have actually improved considerably since the Great Recession. The Department of Education keeps some data on the percentage of 18 to 24-year-olds who are out of school and out of work. And back in 2011, the percentage of people who are out of school and out of work was close to 1 in 5, 18%. So now it's down to 11.5% for 16 to 24-year-olds nationwide. So that is an improvement, but it also tells you how vulnerable young people are to the vagaries of the economy. Who knows what's going to happen with the coronavirus or other economic threats that are on the horizon, but it's the young people who are going to pay the price first, right? They were the last hired and likely to be the first fired. The next downturn is going to bring another, you know, cataclysm for young people as far as their employment prospects, no question.
One thing that I stopped on in the book and said, really, was a statement you made, young adulthood as a phase of life is just a recent phenomenon.
Yes. Generation ago, you know, you could finish high school, go to the factory down the street, get a job at age 18. Young people would get married in their early 20s, have children in their early 20s. All of that has been delayed. The median age at which we are reaching those milestones of true adulthood, marriage, parenthood, financial independence are happening later and later and later. There's a sociologist named Jeffrey Arnett who wrote a book called Emerging Adulthood. He's one of the first to identify this phenomenon, and that was back in 2004 that he wrote this book. Young people need more education, and as one consequence of that, people are taking much more zigzag paths to what their ultimate career is going to be. It's something that used to be called failure to launch. Maybe some people still call it that. But I think more increasingly, middle-class and upper-middle-class parents are beginning to realize that they need to invest a lot more time and they need to invest a lot more money into their young adults to ensure that they have footing in life, because adulthood has become much more uncertain and the requirement for more education has become practically mandatory. So the Federal Reserve, for instance, will tell you that 1 in 3 young adults up to age 24 is still getting help with the bills from mom and dad. And there's another study I found that calculated that the average family will spend about $50,000 on their young adult from 18 to age 30. And some of that will be housing, because a young person will be back in the basement for a while. But all of that is actually part of this new developmental phase that more and more young people are experiencing as this emerging adulthood, as Arnett says. The problem is, of course, when you have lower-income young adults or disadvantaged young adults who don't have the luxury of all those second chances, who don't have the luxury of having that basement to go to, who may be, you know, impoverished or may be coming out of the foster care system at age 18, dumped on the street, literally dumped on the street at that age, suffering in the criminal justice system, or have well-meaning parents but are marooned in places where all the time in the world is not going to create the opportunities that they need.
Still to come, our conversation with Ann Kim continues with a look at why this problem still exists in a low unemployment economy. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. ¶¶ got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Ann Kim, a senior writer and contributing editor at the Washington Monthly and the author of the new book, Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. I asked her why this is still a problem with the unemployment rate at record lows.
Yeah, the job market is great. Again, if you are an incumbent worker with the right skills, the right education, in the right place, I came across a report the other day finding that of innovation jobs, there are really only 5 cities in the United States that accounted for more than half of the innovation jobs were created over the last 5 years. If you're not in one of those cities, if you're not in New York, or if you're in L.A., you're not in Boston, it's much tougher sledding for you. Again, it comes back to this problem of really divergent fortunes. And this divergence is happening at a geographic level, city versus city, family versus family, state versus state, region versus region. There's this winner-take-all phenomenon that's happening at all levels, from communities to states to cities, and it's really driving a gulf, I think, among Americans. And that's one of the things we really need to work on, I think, is to figure out ways to distribute more opportunity more equitably across the country so that, you know, it's not so much an accident of birth whether you succeed or not. Also, one thing to note is that the unemployment rate only counts people who are looking for work. If you are a young person who has dropped out of the workforce, completely discouraged from doing so, you actually don't count in the unemployment rate. Much better number to look at is the so-called employment to population ratio. And if you look there, it's under 60%. For this age group about whether they're in the labor force at all. So the unemployment rate is a misleading figure in some ways because it doesn't count the folks who've given up.
Well, before we make people think that your book is just one big doom and gloom thing, let's talk about some of the success stories you talk about. I want to hone in on one program called Second Story and someone named Carla, whose story you told. Let's tell that story now.
Yes, Carla is a remarkable young woman, but also not, because I think she's an example of how any young person's life can be turned around if they're given the right kind of support and investment. So Carla became pregnant as a teenager. She was kicked out of her house, became homeless, was sleeping on floors. She told me that she was in a home where she woke up in the morning with bed bug bites. I mean, she's went through so many horrific experiences as a 17-year-old pregnant homeless teenager. Second Story is a shelter for expecting moms, teen moms, located in Fairfax County, Virginia. She heard of it from a friend of a friend, and they took her in. And over the course of 4 years, they became her surrogate family. They gave her a place to stay. They connected her to job training opportunities. They got her back in school. They helped her save money. At the end of the 4 years, she'd had enough saved that she could put down a down payment on a small condominium in Fairfax County. When I met her, her life had completely, she was in her mid-20s by this point. Her life had completely stabilized, and she's on the right track. She had a great job at a defense contracting firm in Fairfax County. She has 2 little boys. She's in a stable relationship with her boyfriend, still living in her condo, and she's just a gorgeous young woman. In Second Story made that happen. They have a wait list that's a year long for what they do. They're the only homeless shelter for teens in her situation, like Carla, left in Fairfax County because of budget cuts and just the overall lack of resources. But there should be a lot more stories like Carla's. We know it works. We just need to invest in it.
You do point out there are some things that don't work. You give an example of the Job Corps and how, you know, a lot of that money spent is just going to waste.
Yes, there have been a couple of government evaluations of Jacques Coeur, which is created back in the 60s, 70s. And, you know, unfortunately, government-sponsored job training programs might, you know, justify the bad rap that they get. The most tragic part, I think, is that the lion's share of the $2.5 billion or so that we spend every year on programs targeted to young people who are disconnected. And that $2.5 billion is a pittance, by the way, compared to what we spend on national defense or on Social Security or basically just about anything else. A lot of it is going to this program that is maybe not the most effective way to help young people pick up the pieces and move on. It's a residential program that is supposed to get you your GED and find a job. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who've gone through the program end up in circumstances that are not that much different from when they came in, according to the GAO reports and other evaluations of this program. So I think there can be some better ways to spend the money. And again, we know what they are. And there are many nonprofits that are innovating and doing great things. And so one of the things that needs to happen, if there were more attention paid to how you work with young people who are in these circumstances, some of that attention can go to which programs work the best, and let's put our money there.
Well, you do end the book with 7 steps to ending disconnection. What are some of them that we could talk about now? So just some bullet points here.
Yeah, I'm not going to run through all 7. The easiest one, and I do try very hard to get at this from a bipartisan standpoint. If you're conservative, you really should be interested in this also, because the money we spend now is going to be a lot of money that we save down the road when you turn a disconnected young person into someone who is a tax-paying, productive citizen. But the easiest thing we can start with is to count the number of young people who are both out of school and out of work. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, the United Kingdom and, you know, other places, practically every other place around the world, OECD has statistics that they keep on what are called NEETs. That stands for not in employment, education, and training, or training. And in the UK, every other month or so, they will put out a report that says, you know, our NEET percentage is this. And it helps create kind of a national dialogue and a conversation about, okay, you know, the number went up. This means that we need to do this to help young people. What are we doing in our schools to make sure that more young people are aware of the career options, so they don't lose interest and drop out in that critical period between, you know, 16 and 18 when they're making decisions about their future? If you don't measure it, it doesn't matter. And right now in the United States, we don't measure it, and so it doesn't matter as much as it should. It's a census year this year, right? So to me, it would be a very simple step to analyze the data in such a way that we bring this population of young people into the national spotlight a little bit and recognize them for a group that may need a little bit more attention and a lot more investment and some rethinking about who they are and what young people need to get ahead.
In the end, what is the long-lasting effect of somebody who is in this state of disconnection in their 20s once they hit their 30s and 40s?
It's potentially lifelong. The most tragic case, of course, is if a disconnected young person remains disconnected as an adult, never reconnecting to school or to work. I spoke to some advocates at a homeless shelter for youth, and they say that, you know, folks who work in adult homeless shelters recognize that the pipeline to chronic adult homelessness begins if someone is homeless when they are 20. So that is the most dire circumstance that a young person can find themselves. If a young person who is not connected now does manage to connect in the future, they still pay a lifelong price. I mean, their wages are going to be less. Their likelihood of home ownership is going to be less. The likelihood that they're going to be working full-time will be less. Measure of America calculated that, you know, it could be as high as a $30,000 wage penalty 15 years down the line for someone who is disconnected in those early years. And when you think about your own first job, you know, and what you did between the ages of 18 and 24, 16 and 24, to get that early work experience, to find those first mentors, first bosses, it really does make a difference, those connections you make. It's very hard as a 26-year-old to get that first job, you know, that's going to set you on the right path. So those early years are so critical, and for too many people, they're being wasted.
Again, the name of Ann Kim's new book is Abandoned: America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Some of the most successful students don't feel good about their accomplishments. They feel like imposters. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do you feel like a phony? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Kevin Coakley, distinguished teaching professor at the University of Texas at Austin, examines why college students often feel like they don't belong.
During the academic year, many students will experience heightened imposter feelings in academically competitive and stressful college environments. The imposter phenomenon, often referred to in the popular press as the imposter syndrome, is the sense among high achievers of feeling intellectually phony and fraudulent. While high achievers are typically thought of as individuals who have excelled academically, in many ways college attendance, retention, and graduation make students high achievers, given that more than 20% of freshmen do not return for a second year. Research has found that imposter feelings negatively impact the mental health of college students, increasing feelings of depression and anxiety. Students who feel like an imposter have difficulty internalizing their accomplishments. They see themselves as incompetent and believe they have fooled others into seeing themselves as intelligent and accomplished. Imposter feelings have been linked to maladaptive perfectionism or excessive high personal standards. Imposters and perfectionists are similar in that they are both driven to excel. They differ in that perfectionists are driven by an internal pressure of having high standards, while imposters are driven by an internal experience of intellectual phoniness and self-doubt. My research has found that imposter feelings are especially salient among students of color. However, it is important to keep in mind that students of color are not monolithic. For example, my research has found that Asian American students tend to have higher feelings of imposterism than African American and Latinx students. Additionally, we found a stronger impact of perceived discrimination on imposter feelings among African American and Latinx students. Professors can address imposterism among students of color by including books and articles written by scholars of color, discussing the contributions of scholars of color in your field, and having meetings with students of color and affirming your belief in their potential and deservedness to be there.
That was Kevin Coakley of the University of Texas at Austin. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.